Coming up this week on The Right Side, planners seem deaf to the hurdles of Edmonton LRT expansion. Trudeau's senior advisor defends his friend's cushy diplomat appointment. The government focuses on climate change and not natural resources with NAFTA. And a teachers' union is trying to revise history. This is The Right Side, episode 31, recorded Saturday, August 26th, 2017. Revisionist History. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are here back this week to remove some bias and sensationalism in the news and mainstream media. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. There's been a lot going on this week. Definitely a lot to look out for in the media, especially on a bunch of different issues that we've got here for you today.
Oh, yeah, we got an entire all-encompassing, I guess you could say, palette of issues, ranging from some that are a little bit more local than we do all the way up to the Prime Minister's office. So we're going to get started, but of course, we're going to remove bias and sensationalism as we go through each of these. So I'm going to start off this week with a little story that is related to Edmonton. And, you know, in general, it can be applied to all major cities in Canada that are undergoing development. And what major city in Canada today is not undergoing any kind of major urban planning development, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically what's happening here is that for most of the past decade, Edmonton has had a focus on LRT expansion. For those unaware, LRT refers to light rail. It's basically trains that run through the city and can interact with traffic if need be, compared to traditional commuter rail or subway systems that you see in the U.S. The most recent completion was the downtown to Nate line, which of course goes from the city center to the mid-north end of the city to the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology campus. This line suffered delays and once launched had many issues relating to traffic and signaling. It was about 3 years late on its actual launch when it was aimed to come online and when it actually did. And basically, after it came online, it still suffered from many issues relating to the signal system not working properly, to traffic bottlenecks at the various intersections along the route. So this is not our first foray that we're going to be talking about into problems with LRT planning here in Edmonton. So a report was released last week that states that when the new Valley Line opens in 2019, which goes from downtown to Mill Woods, 18 of the 38 intersections will be congested during the morning rush hour. Of these congestions, greater than 500 meters are expected at six of these potential intersections. During the afternoon rush hour, 16 of 38 intersections are expected to be congested, with five intersections expecting backups of over 500 meters. Now, for a little bit of comparison, 500 meters inside the city is able to span a few city blocks, which, when you think about it, that many cars lined up, multiple lanes, that's a pretty big bottleneck, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when it's through multiple intersections, which
right,
is what it sounds like it would be.
Yeah, and when we fast forward to 2044, it's forecasted that seven intersections could experience morning rush hour waits of greater than 500 meters. It's also worth noting that this would be a car queue of about 600 vehicles waiting in a lineup of greater than 500 meters. City Council had an option to elevate the LRT at five intersections at a cost of $220 million, but it was rejected because the studies done found it would not reduce congestion in any meaningful way. In a response to this report that came out this past week, Mayor Dawn Iveson told reporters, quote, "You can make modifications and you can widen roads up to a point, but you need something transformational, a strategic shift. That's why we're building the LRT. We're introducing trade-offs for sure, but it makes sure that hundreds of thousands of people travel by train." So, well, in an ideal planning world for the city, we would, you know, hope that the availability and convenience of such a transit system will encourage people to travel more by train. But for anyone who lives outside of the core in a newer developing area, it's just not feasible to get down to the core points of the city where people want. And plus, there are also some people that, you know, after they go to their main office during the day, they need to travel throughout the rest of the city to do the work that they need to do. So all in all, it's a little bit presumptuous to assume that the residents should want to use mass transit and at that to try and actually force them to use mass transit. Along with this, the City of Edmonton's mayor office also tweeted an infographic citing, "As major cities grow, so will traffic congestions. All Edmonton intersections will be busier in 2044. Reliable Edmonton transit is essential." So they say 660 people can fit roughly 600 cars. And that is the equivalent of one train. So that is the logic that the City of Edmonton is applying here. And they're, of course, with this encouraging most people to travel by train once these new train lines come into service eventually. But the story goes on because there's one single area to this that hasn't received any coverage in the mainstream media this week. And that matter is that it is an election year here in Edmonton come October. So in October, we'll be choosing a new mayor, potentially city council and school board trustees. And for such a huge issue that changes traffic patterns, costs millions of dollars, and is ultimately taking years of development, you would think that there would be some questioning from the media, talking to prospective candidates or even the incumbents running and asking them what their thoughts on this. So from what we can tell here at the Right Side, there really hasn't been any discussion on this matter with the majority of the candidates that are out there in the mainstream media about this huge issue. Because when we're talking about potential options in these strategic plans that can cost $220 million to elevate the train at specific intersections, that's a lot of money when you just consider that's one aspect of it. And when you apply it to the entire project, that's talking billions and billions of dollars. But, you know, as the election starts to ramp up, we should really be hopeful that there's going to be a little bit more discussion on this. And, you know, with such a report coming out like this, in the middle of when the campaign is first getting started, it's just really shocking that the media didn't ask any of the candidates about this, because these studies were done before construction began and before the designs were finalized. It's just that these reports are now being made public after construction has begun. And there's lots of people scratching their heads about why a project that has 250 meters or 500 meters of potential queue time didn't really get thought of when that was going through consultation, and why it didn't make it out into the public. And that's something that the current city council should be held accountable to.
Yeah, and this seems like something that would be a major issue in a municipal election, especially a city as big as Edmonton, right? Where transportation issues are likely to be a big problem. I know that here in Victoria, we have a lot of traffic issues with main routes due to construction, and I know that Vancouver is one of the worst cities in North America for traffic issues of its size. So something like this that would back up traffic by quite a bit, especially in the downtown core where there's going to be a lot of people down there. It's a major issue.
Oh yeah, 500 meters is half a kilometer. And when you put that out in a straight line with cars lining up, they say it could potentially be 600 plus cars. That's a lot. And that's something that should have come up publicly before now. And questions needed to be asked back then, but unfortunately, this report was kept private, and that was part of the private consultations done about the project. And, you know, we're just finding out about now, which is really unfortunate.
Well, thanks to the mayor's office tweet, we now know that 600 cars, that would be about the length of the backup. That's one train car length, right?
Exactly. And they want to take them off the road and encourage people to use public transit. But like we said, that's not always feasible when you have not everybody working in the downtown core. So, And I mean, let's be real. In Edmonton, it goes down to minus 30 in the winters. Who wants to be waiting for a connection bus in minus 30?
Yeah.
So,
in fact, not only is that not do people not want to do that? In some cases, especially for, you know, the elderly or the really young families or not something, that's, it's not even safe to be doing that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the only way this transit system is going to work if you need to get to somewhere that's relatively remote is you're going to have to finish your route by bus. And you're going to have to do that going there and coming back, which, I mean, obviously this is geared towards the core, but still, let's let the people make their own decisions if they want to be forced out of their cars or not. There was also a few other interesting things on this pertaining to the candidates who are running in this election and their use of social media. As I mentioned, there was no real media coverage of the candidates about this story, but a few of them did actually take to social media to voice their support for releasing this data ahead of construction. And those that did were Payman Parsayan of Ward 9, Tish Prowse of Ward 6, Sarah Hamilton of Ward 5, and Rocco Caterina of Ward 4. And with about 69 candidates running in the municipal election, it's a little shocking that we only have about four of them here who have voiced some form of opinion on the matter on social media. And, you know, as the lead up to this election continues, we'll definitely be watching for potential issues like this that can crop up that should be being talked about but aren't yet by the media. So. All right. What do you got for Canada this week?
Yeah, so I'm going to actually do something different, and I'm not going to do a BC story. It's been a pretty slow week in BC this week for news, especially. Just a couple headlines is that the provincial government isn't going to support Victoria's Commonwealth Games bid because they said it would cost too much money for little benefit. It seems like a lot of people agree with that decision. What people aren't agreeing with is the decision to eliminate all toll fees on bridges in the Lower Mainland. Instead, they are going to be paid for from taxpayer money from all of BC.
I wonder if that was talked about in the campaign.
That was talked about in the election. I'm not sure if they were going to do it right away. They were said that they were going to wait to lower the fees and then keep them on for longer until it's paid off. But now they're getting rid of it completely, so who knows what's going to happen there. And the other big news was that the BC government posted a massive surplus due to the BC Liberals. And it ended up being about $2.7 billion, I believe. And there were a lot of questions about whether that surplus was actually going to make its way back to the citizens of BC, or if the new NDP government was just going to spend the revenue on a lot of social programs and whatnot, as they've been known to do. But I mean, other than that, it really hasn't been that busy in BC. So right now we've got a different story for you. It'll go straight to Canada, and we'll have one here where Trudeau and the Liberals are under fire again in many of the media outlets for the appointment of Rana Sekar, who is a close friend of Trudeau's closest advisor, Gerald Butts. Now, he's being appointed to a diplomatic post in San Francisco, and questions are being raised as Sekar is a unsuccessful former candidate for the Liberal Party in the 2011 election, and he was a failed nominee in the 2015 election. And not only that, he's also being paid almost double what the normal pay range would be for that position. Sekar will be making between $221,300 to $260,300 for a post that's classified at a level that carries an official pay range of $119,600 to $140,700. So Gerald Butts, of course, he wants to defend his friend, so he took to Twitter and posted a bunch of tweets. He argued in a 15-part Twitter thread that it was in line with other hirings from the private sector. And he said that it's around the same range of three other appointees that the Liberals have recruited for diplomatic posts from outside the government. But the only one on the list in a comparable position as Consul General, Phyllis Yaffe, who got posted to New York City, which is arguably a more important role, she actually earned significantly less. You may remember former Minister of Immigration John McCallum, who was appointed ambassador to China, and former Minister of Foreign Affairs Stéphane Dion, who's now ambassador to Germany and special envoy to the European Union, are both paid a salary ranging between $214,200 and $252,000. So the San Francisco appointment actually makes Sarkar one of the highest paid Canadian diplomats in the Foreign Service. The union representing more than 1,500 Canadian diplomats says that since Trudeau is willing to pay nearly double to appoint a diplomat with ties to the Liberal Party, the government better keep in mind the current pay scale of Foreign Service officers next time they're at the bargaining table. The Professional Association of Foreign Service Officers, or PAFSO, said while it recognizes the government's right to appoint who they see fit for those positions, it should keep in mind that there are hundreds of professional Foreign Service officers already doing their jobs on behalf of Canada for often much less pay. Quote, we do, however, hope that the employer will bear in mind this salary scale in its negotiations with the professional Foreign Service, both Foreign Service and the executive level, who are already performing these functions on behalf of Canada in missions around the world, PAFSO President Pamela Isfeld said in an emailed statement to CTV News. So it's kind of known now that Sarkar's appointment is not just going to be a sticking point because of the money that he's making, but it's going to impact future union negotiations, and that will probably cost taxpayers even more money in the future. Mr. Butts actually argued on Twitter that the government recruited Mr. Sarkar because he has experience and skills that are an excellent fit for a job that notably includes efforts to attract investment from Silicon Valley. He even tried to suggest that Sarkar took a pay cut to take the job, which is something that opposition MPs say won't make sense with Canadians, given that the salary is at least $220,000 a year and that it's somewhat
a pay cut to $220,000 a year. That must be a nice world.
Oh, yeah. It's a pay cut, even though he's making double what the diplomat normally would in that position. It's probably because he's coming from the private sector. Now, Sarkar was he was the CEO of the Canadian Indian Business Council, and he was also in a high-paying position with KPMG. So I guess in that sense, he's taking a bit of a pay cut because he's coming from private enterprise. But isn't that generally known that you're going to take a pay cut when you come to government? I mean, back in the day, people took up jobs in government because they were doing their duty to serve the country.
That's the way it should
be. A lot of the time, they didn't take pay to begin with. It's only more recently, since the Second World War, that people are actually taking money to be politicians. Before, it was just what you could call a night job, and they would do that on top of what they did on their day job. So it's kind of funny that he mentioned that he's taking a pay cut to $220,000 a year. And it's also someone with close ties to the PMO. So, of course, after all this, I looked through a bunch of replies to Gerald Butts' comments, and quite rightly, I think he was blasted on Twitter for his reasonings. But what's even more interesting is that in the 2015 election, the Liberals campaigned on a promise to, you know, have an open, fair appointments process and to take the partisanship out of appointments. I mean, it's no doubt that Sarkar's credentials in business, they're clearly beyond reproach, but it's his Liberal affiliation that raises questions and that a lot of people are questioning based on the salary that he's getting. So New Democrat MP Nathan Collins said, quote, I think there's a lot of qualified people who are also not best friends with the Prime Minister's aide. This seems to be the blind spot with the Liberals. When appointing friends to positions, they just seem to have no ability to see how the general public will perceive friends helping friends. So Colin is referring to Trudeau's almost appointment of Madeleine Mayer to Official Languages Commissioner, where Mayer was touted by Heritage Minister Melanie Joly for her qualifications, but was also conveniently an Ontario MPP for the Liberals from 2003 to 2016, and had actually met with members of the PMO before the appointment, which include the aforementioned Gerald Butts, and also Trudeau's Chief of Staff, Katie Telford. So after intense scrutiny from both Conservatives and the NDP and the House of Commons, that appointment was ultimately cancelled. However, with the Parliament currently on recess until September, it appears that the Liberals are trying to push appointments like Sarkar's through with little oversight from both opposition parties and the media. So, speaking of little oversight from the media...
Oh, now here's where the story gets good.
The CBC also ran a top article on the topic, but they also omitted a lot of key information. The article written by Chris Hall devotes half of the article to Sarkar's business qualifications, which I said before, they're very good. Clearly, he's very qualified for the job. And most of the rest of the article was devoted to diplomatic appointees of the Harper government, like Gary Dewar, who made roughly the same amount. But not mentioned is that most of these diplomats were appointed to positions that were much higher than Sarkar's. And also, Sarkar's liberal affiliations are glossed over in just a few words, and not much attention is put on them whatsoever, which is actually what the big deal is here. Hall actually finishes his article with a very slanted sentence, quote, "The challenge now for the Liberals is to convince the public that Sarkar is the best person for the job he's been given, instead of whether he's worth the price." So with that, it's kind of hard to take the article seriously, and it kind of just adds more evidence that it's really important to diversify your sources when you're reading the news. Just given on the fact that that very sentence right there is, it's almost trying to convince us that that he's the best person for the job. But really, when you think about it, he's certainly qualified. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it's because he's like highly affiliated with the Liberals, and it's a very partisan appointee to a nonpartisan position, and the fact that he's making over double the amount, I think that's what the media is missing here on this front.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you sum the entire article up with that very slanted sentence. It's almost a question of, okay, this is going to happen, but let's just convince the public that he's worth the price. And you know, there's no integrity going back to the 2015 campaign of their promise to, like you said, make the appointment process transparent and appoint people with the appropriate merit. And as you can see here, like you said in the article, the CBC did gloss over the Liberal Party links. And with that, you know, that kind of takes away some of the journalistic integrity here. So, and you know, it is unfortunate that that Parliament is not sitting to have the enhanced scrutiny on this appointment. So we'll just have to see if this one ends up getting put in.
Well, unfortunately, this one's already being put in. So whether it happens or not, I think is kind of a moot point. And I think they've probably learned from what happened with Madeleine Meyer, and they're trying to put it kind of, you know, behind the back of the Canadian public on this one, because they're trying to do it in the middle of summer where there's not going to be much attention on it. And they also tried to release it when there was a lot of other attention based on other articles as well. So
same thing that happened with the Cotter payout.
Exactly. There wasn't very much attention put on this whatsoever, only a little bit in the Globe and Mail and, of course, the aforementioned CBC article.
All right. Well, that's the Liberal Party being who they are then, and the CBC being who they are, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to see if they're going to try and do any other appointments like this, and we'll keep you guys informed whenever they do.
Alrighty then, our next story is pertaining to the NAFTA renegotiation talks that are happening. And the story we're going with this week is that climate change is still a priority in NAFTA talks, according to the Canadian Environment Minister. So at a recent Donald Trump rally in Arizona, the U.S. president said, "We'll end up probably terminating NAFTA at some point." And of course, this set off alarm bells across Canada through the media and of course with the government. So anyone who's been watching the U.S. president with an objective eye will note that this is how he starts a negotiation. And you can take, for example, his ban on Muslims entering the U.S. that was later limited to extreme vetting and then only to certain countries and classes of citizens. So the mistake should not be made that the negotiations between Canada and U.S. and Mexico with regards to NAFTA are happening, and we should have our full attention on that. So following this, our environment minister, Catherine McKenna, stated that, quote, climate change is still a priority in talks with U.S. officials on NAFTA. And, of course, the U.S. view on climate change here is seen as a major hurdle in these negotiations, but our environment minister sees this as, quote, heated rhetoric and climate change as they should be one of our key negotiating points. So whether or not this strengthens or weakens our negotiating hand is something that the Canadian government must ultimately decide on. So with a U.S. administration that is not pursuing climate change agenda, it doesn't make sense to predicate our negotiations on climate change. For example, because NAFTA has a major role on the Canadian economy purely from an import and export perspective. 50% of the GDP from New Brunswick and 49% of the GDP in Ontario rely on American trade. The Prairie provinces hover in around the 30% range, while Quebec and Newfoundland are in the mid-20s, and BC and the Atlantic provinces are in the teens. So with this, it's quite clear that Canada relies on NAFTA more than the Americans do from a pure import and export perspective. On the other hand, Canada is the single most important market to 35 of the U.S. states, but their economies do not depend on Canada and NAFTA the same way the Canadian provinces do. So one thing that's not really being talked about in the media with this is the alternative approach that the Canadian government could be following for this. So one potential approach that the government could follow in regards for NAFTA negotiations relates to our natural resources. So if you consider all the natural resources in North America unchained, they have the potential to become energy independent for the North American continent and further allow this continent to become an energy superpower. Along with energy, we also have the capacity for an immense manufacturing industry, and a new NAFTA agreement could focus on energy, manufacturing, and trade in an effort to rival the industrial manufacturing monstrosities that we see in China and India and other developing countries. So while the Canadian government is ultimately free to take its climate change approach on NAFTA, the media should be asking, what else can Canada get out of NAFTA? What can we do to get the best deal? What can Canada do to ensure fair trade between us, the U.S., and Mexico? What can NAFTA do to enable freer trade and fairer prices of oil, timber, and other natural resources? And I specifically mentioned timber because softwood lumber always seems to be an issue that keeps coming up as a problem, and maybe NAFTA might be one vehicle to solving that. It's also a little known fact that oil sold to the U.S. sells at a lower rate than the advertised price per barrel that we often see on the news. And that price we see on the news is known as West Texas Intermediate. Canadian oil is often sold at what's called Western Canada Select, which on average is roughly $10 per barrel lower than the WTI price. So as you can see here, there's lots of other angles that our NAFTA negotiations could take. And one thing I think that we should see more of in the media is a question of whether or not pursuing the climate change agenda of NAFTA is perhaps in the best interest of the Canadian economy and the people that live in Canada.
Yeah, and with so much of our economy based on natural resources, I mean, the oil in Alberta, the natural gas in northern BC, the potash and uranium that's in Saskatchewan, diamonds that are in the Northwest Territories, hydroelectricity in Quebec, softwood lumber in BC, all of the manufacturing that's based in Ontario, oil that's in Newfoundland. I mean, there's so many natural resources that in all stretches of our country. And it makes sense to have a better trade agreement with America because they're so close to us. But I think in this sense, when you look back on the import-export amounts, it's interesting to note that the most of the GDP that's being traded with the United States is places that are in the central Canada region, and the places on the coast are able to trade, obviously, with other places such as Asia or Europe. So it makes sense to have better trade with America, but I think if Trump is going to play hardball on this, I think what Canada needs to do is to have better interprovincial trade, where we are able to share our natural resources with other parts of the country,
Oh yeah, most definitely.
and right now with governments being stalling on things like pipelines or other trading in between manufacturing centers in Ontario and other parts of the country where the natural resources are being created. Really, it's almost like it's not just one country that's trying to negotiate with the states. It's almost like it's 10 separate provinces. And I think that's something that the Canadian government needs to reconcile in this part, is that trade is a really, really big issue, and
It's
it's
technically
what's going
also
to
a federal responsibility.
and it's what drives the Canadian economy, is whether we are able to get good deals on this. And in a lot of cases, we don't get good deals on our trade goods, simply because we rely on the United States more than they rely on us.
Right, case in point, the difference in oil price.
Yeah, or the amount of hydroelectricity that we give them, both from BC and from Quebec, or the large amount of potash that's created. Most of the uranium in North America comes from Saskatchewan. I mean, softwood lumber, it's really easy to get at, and it's being sold for a super, super cheap price in the States because of tariffs. I mean, if it's really free trade, we're not really getting a good deal on it.
It's becoming free trade, not fair trade. And
Exactly.
that's what the renegotiations of this deal should be talking about, but I don't think it makes much sense to be talking about climate change when the US administration doesn't have a focus on that. I think we might be missing a huge opportunity here, like you said, to be focusing in on areas pertaining to the natural resources sector and ensuring that the trade is fair. And along with that, maybe shoring up the trade policies between provinces. So,
Which is also the federal government's responsibility.
right. And I mean, you hear NAFTA, and of course, all the focus goes to Trump wanting to tear the deal up. But of course, what's forgot about is the individual provinces and what's at stake for Canada and potentially what could come from this. And, you know, maybe this will happen as the coverage continues and we get closer to, you know, deeper into the talks of renegotiating the deal. But as it's seen so far, it seems as though most of the talk is focused around fear-mongering of what the US government could potentially do with NAFTA versus instead of what we need to be focused on and how we can make it a better deal for Canadians.
Yeah, and that's something that the Canadian media does a lot of. They very much like to focus on what Trump says, but they're not actually talking about what our government is doing in response and what they're going to do in negotiations. Now, it seems like every week now for the past month and a half or so, there's been a new article about NAFTA, but we haven't really covered it very much until today because there really hasn't been that much new about it. But I think it was an important topic to talk about because of the opportunity that the government has to really get a good deal for Canadians, and the fact that they're not seeming to hit the mark with this.
Right, they're focusing in on climate change instead, with an administration that has zero interest in talking about that. So, I don't know. We'll have to see what the Canadian delegation brings to the trade table, but as it's looking right now, we might not be getting a good deal out of this. So, media needs to highlight that the government needs to get its act together and focus on what is right for Canadians. All right, let's talk about our first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald.
Yeah, so a bit of a follow-up to our story last week. You'll remember the violent clashes that erupted in Charlottesville, Virginia, after the proposed removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Calls to remove other Confederate monuments have grown as well. And after several were removed, worry set upon U.S. President Donald Trump. He, of course, turned to Twitter, warning of what could come if cities continue to take down statues that offend some people. He said, quote, "Who's next? Washington? Jefferson? So foolish." Up until recently, of course, Canadians were looking on the Americans with a bit of a holier-than-thou attitude about the matter. Well, how on earth could that happen down there? It would never happen up here. Well, actually, it's happening up here. We're now having our own George Washington moment. So an ongoing debate about First Prime Minister Sir John A. Macdonald's legacy has been recharged this week with a resolution passed by the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario that recommends the province's schools rename facilities bearing the first prime minister's moniker, given Macdonald's role in the, quote, genocide against Indigenous people. So Felipe Pareja, which is a French teacher in the Peel region just west of Toronto, is behind the motion, with which won support at a meeting of the ETFO this week. Pareja says he acknowledges Macdonald's foundational role in the country's confederation, but that having public schools bearing his name leaves out his role in the starvation of Indigenous people along the railway to facilitate its construction, along with Macdonald's, quote, central role as the architect of really what was genocide of the Indigenous peoples, end quote. In a statement, Premier Kathleen Wynne said that the union's motion, quote, missed the mark. She described Macdonald as being far from perfect, but praised him for his contributions to the creation of a stable federal government for Canada. She said it was more important for Ontarians to focus on how to enact meaningful reconciliation with Indigenous peoples than to scrub his name from schools. So as Heritage Minister in the Harper government, James Moore oversaw preparations to mark the 200th anniversary of Macdonald's birth in 2015. Speaking by phone from Vancouver, he said he understands why some might be disturbed by the legacy of Canada's first prime minister. Quote, he was a deeply imperfect man, Mr. Moore said. But, quote, the fact is, Canada would not exist without John A. Macdonald. He is the great, indispensable man of Canadian history. Rather than erasing Macdonald from historical memory, Mr. Moore said, educators need to understand the reality of John A. Macdonald, to teach his flaws and his virtues, and embrace our history, not run away from it. So this kind of debate sort of spread across Canada as the story first brought out, as many local media posed the question to their constituents. Here in Victoria, Czech News asked, should Victoria consider removing the statue of Sir John A. Macdonald outside of City Hall? At the end of the article, of which there was a lot of talk about Macdonald's record against the Indigenous, there was a poll asking, should we remove the statue, yes or no? And 80% of over 2,000 viewers said that this statue should not be removed. Now, Victoria City Councillor Charlene Thornton-Joe sits on a witness reconciliation committee with Mayor Lisa Helps and Councillor Marianne Alto, who is also its First Nations liaison. The committee met for the first time in July and plans to meet again in September, when the issue will be discussed further, she said. Quote, we'll look at what should be considered and what the First Nations would like to see, whether it's removal to a new location or adding a plaque to add more, quote, historical context, she said. How do we learn from our wrongs if we don't know what the wrongs were? She said the plaque would be a way to note both Macdonald's positive achievements and controversial policies. So even though there's only 20% of support for the statue, which is a pretty vocal minority, it looks like they're already trying to discuss what's going to happen about it.
Right. And, you know, we had a similar kind of situation happen with this in Edmonton. The mayor was asked about a park named Oliver Park, downtown Edmonton. This is, of course, not exactly the John A. Macdonald story, but there was some question about whether or not the park should be renamed. And the mayor's personal view was that Oliver Park should, rather than being renamed, we should just remember the history behind the name instead. So it seems as though we're divided into three camps on this. The people who want the total renaming or removal of the statues in question, or in case of Edmonton, the park. In the middle, you have the people who are fine with keeping the name and the legacy, Kathleen Wynne, for example, and our mayor. But instead, we should remember what exactly those names mean. Then on the other hand, you have people who feel that this is indeed a part of history and we need to respect history as it is.
Mm-hmm. But it seems that not all of the teachers in the teachers union hold this hold the same opinion, of course. JDM Stewart, who is a high school teacher in Toronto, wrote a special article to the Globe and Mail entitled, quote, "Don't Hold Sir John A. Macdonald to 2017's Values." In it, he describes Macdonald's record and that by removing statues, we lose a chance to learn about the history of the founding of our country. Quote, "Attempts to erase Sir John A. Macdonald from public history do not make sense. In fact, they reveal a narrow understanding of history and its people. Does John A. Macdonald have warts in terms of his historical record and belief? Of course. He was no fan of Chinese immigration. Of course. Interestingly, the subsequent government of Sir John or Sir Wilfrid Laurier raised the head tax from $500 from $50. No one has called for the renaming of Wilfrid Laurier's scrolls just yet.
And what happens when are we to remove both these figures from our banknotes next?
Yeah, I mean, give them an inch and they'll take a mile, as they say, right?
You would need to rename an entire neighborhood here in Edmonton if we were to scrub Laurier's name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Stewart also notes that there's really a growing trend of people applying 2017's morality and justice to historical figures who lived in a different era with different thinking. This is called presentism, and it's difficult to judge the actions of historical figures based on present-day ideals. Now, a bit of a lighthearted part of this was that a humorous satirical article in the National Post argues that if McDonald's name is to be stripped off schools, then many other institutions should have name changes as well from historical figures for a variety of reasons, from racism to sexism to support for Nazi Germany to opposition to same-sex marriages to cultural appropriation to slave ownership to statements that said today would just be simply politically incorrect. Places that are named in the article include the aforementioned Victoria, British Columbia, McGill University, Brantford, Ontario, the Chateau Laurier, the CCGS John G. Diefenbaker, the Jacques Cartier Bridge, Bell Canada, Tommy Douglas, Mount Douglas, Dalhousie University, Alma Lacar University, Louis Riel Day, Mount Mackenzie King, Kitchener, Ontario, Lake Champlain, Pearson International Airport, and, of course, anything named after Winston Churchill. Of course, the point is that historical figures from many different backgrounds, eras, and political spectrums are not going to be perfect according to 2017 standards, and that things are not always black and white. And by removing statues, we lose a chance to educate about Canada's flawed past, but how instrumental that past was to creating the great country we all love today. Let's not forget about the past, good or bad, because those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And for a teachers' union who really should know better, to change history and influence what kids can learn about is reprehensible.
There you go. That's the ultimate summary right there, to think of that this came from a teachers' union when all in all teachers should be teaching about history and where we came from and what makes Canada, Canada. And just to add on to that list of things that need to be renamed is Ottawa's McDonald Cartier Airport.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's many different places, like almost all of our airports are named after historical figures, a lot of our schools, libraries, sports centers. I mean, you name it, there's practically a name for it. I mean, most of the main street names here in Victoria are named after historical figures that are important to Victoria. And I'm sure they hold a lot of views that, you know, wouldn't be kosher in today's times. But we're still going to have our street names named after them. So, I mean, to just rename them from elementary schools, it doesn't really make sense, because kid's going to go into school and he's going to say, why is our school named this? Because I remember when I went to school, I wanted to know why my school was called Strawberry Vale. And I actually looked it up, and I found that it used to be, back when Victoria was first settled, it was a farmland, and it used to grow strawberries for the region. So that's why it's called Strawberry Vale. Now, people are going to look back on, say, McDonald Elementary, and they're going to say, well, who is McDonald? Let me look at who he is. They're going to find out not only was he instrumental to creating Canada, which is a big deal, he was our first prime minister, which is also a big deal, but that he also held all these different views. And, you know, why Why, in today's time, that wouldn't be great. This is a really good chance for people to educate themselves on who he was and what he did. And I think by removing the name, it wouldn't do good for anyone, I think.
Yeah, it's a real disservice to history and, you know, what Canada is about, I think, as much as any other country. It's built by its history, and that's something that you know, people can choose to follow or choose not to follow. But when you follow it, you want to make sure that you're getting the exact full representation of what it is. Otherwise, you're doing yourself a disservice about learning about who you are and where you came from. So,
mm-hmm. And I think that leads nicely into our word of the week this week, which is revisionism, which is defined as the advocacy of revision of some political theory, religious doctrine, historical or critical interpretation. Now, it's very interesting because it's very hard to find a definition of revisionism, which I could consider ironic, but it's kind of used in the sense of people revising history. You know, there's always that old quote, history is written by the winners. And it seems in this case, the winners are the people, are the teachers who are teaching the history. And they're able to form a union that will decide who gets taught what. And by revising history, by removing, you know, names from statues, or, you know, taking statues down or renaming schools or anything other to do with that, I think you're basically trying to revise history and trying to sweep it under the rug. And I think that's something that really shouldn't be done in today's times, because if anything, I think more information is needed about what happened in the past and what we can do in the future.
Right.
Because when you look in the news these days, there's so much fake information out there, and there's so much bias, so much sensationalism, which we always try and do every week to try and cut through and make sure that we present the best side of the story and what's correct about it. And I think by doing so, we're able to educate a lot more people about what's happening. And by doing so, a lot of people are educated more about all the issues that are happening. So I think people who are trying to revise what happens in history, they're not doing a good thing for Canada.
Indeed. And, you know, take the biggest conflict that you can think of, the biggest war that you can think of, and now revise key elements out of that from the history teaching of that conflict. It changes the entire characterization of what that was. And in doing so, in engaging in revisionism for Canada and whatnot, you are taking a significant part out of Canada. Whether or not people like that, history is in the past and it is fact. There is no fake history unless it is revisionist history. So with that being said, I think we have stumbled on perhaps in Canada the biggest batch of revisionism we're going to see this year, unless something larger, of course, happens.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see, of course. I mean, we've been surprised before on issues.
All right. Well, with that being said, that's it for this episode of The Right Side. Thank you for joining us, everyone. If you want to find full show notes, that's at rightsidenews.ca. We're on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca. You can find the show on YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/YouTube, and we're also on iTunes at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we will be here. We will not be revised. We will see you next week.